What?
No, I'm asking if he would like to, to get some get to the living library to talk with someone. I'm saying it's totally, I accept it, it's collegium, but I think it's a bit costly at the level of say, primary education. We group people, we group children.
We group children because we had to, right? Because we did not have the resources to provide them with the support and the guidance that they need from time to time.
Yep.
We don't have to do that anymore because we have the internet. And we will have things like personal assistance. And everybody loves the Neal Stephenson book, The Diamond Age, with the child's primer. It's a computer that the child always has with her, etc. The idea of a personal interactive tutor, if you will. So we could do that now. So we don't need the economy of mass production, which is what the schoolroom is, right? We don't need the mechanism where the same presentation of content can be given to 30 people all at once, or 40, or whatever the class size is. We don't need it because we don't have to. We have digital technology now. We have books that talk to you, books you can argue with. I'm being a little self-referential here now.
Excuse me, are you saying that using an e-book or any kind of e-education is comparable and can replace a human factor, like a real person talking to you? Is it what you're saying?
In time, that will be the case.
Yeah, but do you think that it will work for everyone? Doesn't that make a proper qualitative difference between human and a non-human factor? I still,
What I was talking about, the use of this technology would occur in an environment where children, instead of being grouped in classes, of their peers, would actually be part of the broader society, working with people who would be role models for them. So they're working and interacting with people, but they have support for the knowledge and learning that they don't have in the form of these advanced e-books.
Yes, but what about those role models? Are they teachers, or do they actually operate from home? Or
they're actual people. If the child, for whatever reason, and there's all kinds of ways this could happen, decides that he or she likes law, courts, could happen. Then this child would become part of the court system, right? So they'd be in the same environment as lawyers and judges, and stenographers and clerks and all of that, and they would have a functional role in this, not a huge role, obviously, because they're kids, right? But they'd be part of that system.
Yeah, but that does not happen when a kid is 7, does it?
Well, it
and right
did
now,
happen.
No.
It did happen because when we were in, say, 15th century, it was very normal. There were a number of pages or gothers. Okay,
yeah.
The system of apprenticeship that we talked a little bit about, it's a paradox that we're going full circle, because the system of apprenticeship as a way of learning, practicing, okay, being a part of, say, court system. Here, I can imagine a child, say, 10-year-old, being a gopher in a court, listening to things, participating in things.
But he might not be very grateful when he's 20, right?
Well, he needs...
You have to put the child into the situation. I can't really imagine most children stepping out and saying, okay, this is where I'm envisioning myself right now and for the rest of my life.
Well,
they need to try.
But the thing is, you're not. This is where we're different from the old system. In the old system, you forced the child to do this, right?
Because
in the new system, you give the child autonomy. If they don't like being in a courtroom, they can go somewhere else.
There will be a world with lots of stables with horses, if I imagine my daughters.
Yeah. Or they might have an affinity for being in the forest, and they'd learn forestry and forest management, or, maple syrup cultivation if they're Canadian.
Is it practically implementable, really? A nice courtroom manager might welcome children.
From time to time,
but it's quite impossible, I think, for every state-owned institution. That's not even mentioned private enterprises. For all of them to be so welcoming and supportive.
Really educating,
this won't happen tomorrow.
Okay. You are hoping for a demographic low, like a real low, when we have so few children.
Plug.
We can manage that.
Well, that would help it for sure.
Child force. Yeah. It's very interesting.
I mean, it's funny.
And
I'm listening, and yours is not. First reaction of this that I've heard, and again, this is not something that would happen overnight, obviously, but people talk about how hard it would be to do this, and yet look at what we do now. We build special buildings, like entire multi-million dollar buildings. We spend tens of thousands of dollars, or thirties or forties of thousands of zlotys, that's financial transactions on the every year per child, right? As though we could afford this.
But in your vision, are we doing away with schools altogether?
So most of the function of the delivery of instruction, some coaching, some support, etc., is delivered electronically. Some of this function is performed by individuals who act as representatives and advocates for children in these different environments. Some of it is done by the mentors or the people who are in the workplace that they're working with and for. So, the tasks are spread out. We have a model right now where one person, the teacher, does a whole bunch of these different things. And that becomes more and more difficult and more expensive over time. And you get problems like in the United States, for example, where the need is so great that it's the richest country in the world, they pay teachers less money than it costs to live. The salaries are ridiculous. They're very low. Teachers are very poor in the United States, with the result that the educational system there is in crisis. Other countries like Canada, like Finland, where the priorities are a bit different, they're able to pay more, but the cost of providing teachers is an ongoing issue. So the system we have is very resource intensive and very expensive. It does not scale worldwide. It simply doesn't. You look at what would be needed to teach every child on the planet, that would cost more money than there is.
I would just be worried that, in a system like that, which I think is a very nice thing, really. I can imagine a perfect world in which it works.
Yes.
But I would somehow, I'd be worried that some kind of general education is escaping the child. For ideas to be born, I believe they have to be born on some ideas. You need language to talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
You need knowledge to see the connectivity, the connections between them. You need tools to do things. And I'd be worried that the foundation is missing.
Okay. We can talk a lot about what exactly that foundation is. Again, I was in a seminar in the United States where a person was arguing, very similar to you, foundations were absolutely necessary, and then they included religion as one of those foundations. All right, and I sort of, and everybody else in the room is, because it's the United States, yes, of course. And I'm sort of sitting there, you know, as the Canadian guy, wait, what?
Maybe a cultural difference, too.
You might be a cultural
difference. I would agree with that. So there is quite a spectrum of people here. Yeah.
But I like to, I look at mathematics as something that people consider foundational, but mathematics is a very general work, right? Right now we think of the foundation of mathematics as being addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, moving on maybe to fractions, and so on, the typical curriculum. But in the philosophy of mathematics, the foundations are things like sets and groupings, categorization. substitutivity, the idea that the number two can represent two dogs or two apples. That's an advanced concept, but it's foundational. So when we say mathematics is foundational, what do we mean? Again, I don't know if... Do they show Sesame Street here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sesame Street's really interesting because their version of foundational is very different from the school curriculum. One thing that they have, I don't know, it depends on your age. Sesame Street came after I was a child, but I watched it anyways.
Yeah, we all do.
Yeah.
So,
there's this thing, this little song. Three of these things belong together. Three of these things are kind of the same. One of these things does not belong. Can you tell which one? And they have these, apple and an orange and a lemon and a truck. Which one doesn't belong? Right. So. An egg, yeah, good, exactly. Yeah, I picked truck because it was. That's foundational. That's mathematically foundational. It's set theory, it's categorization, but it's not what any curriculum would call foundational.
And you can teach it through Sesame Street, you don't have to go to school.
And you can teach it through Sesame Street. And that, I did this talk today with all this formal theory, and it was a little too formal, I'm sorry, but this formal theory of connectivism and association, etc. Three of these things belong together is the foundation for that. Right? Three of these things, this is the beginning of connectivist associationist reasoning. Right? So, what is foundational? And then finally, there's the argument I first heard from Seymour Papert, and it's a good argument. It's a very simple argument. If it's foundational, then they will learn it when they are doing the thing that motivates them to learn. Right? Let's take language. If language is so important, then you will learn language while you're trying to do, be in a court or be in a forest or, you'll learn it.
Yeah, but also in the process of knowledge production, won't you keep reinventing the wheel if you don't just listen to a lecture where we tell you that it has already been invented?
Yeah. That's the argument from Paul Kirchner and what's his name? Sweller? Right, yeah. So, I'll give them their premise. It is more efficient to just tell people fundamental principles than to have them discover that for themselves. Totally agree. I'll even go further, and they write a lot about things like worked examples, for example. They're coming from a scientific background. They studied science the same way I studied science. You have your textbook, and you have your questions at the end of the chapter, and the good textbooks had a bunch of worked examples, and then you would do similar examples with different variables. the bad textbooks, and there were many, would have question sets where the answers, the questions at the end of the chapter, were not covered in the chapter. I hated those. And what happens, and the way they were designed, right, was that you read the chapter and then you're supposed to make this mental leap to kind of see the world in the right way, and then you would deduce for yourself the principle that would help you answer the question at the end of the chapter. Computer science texts are full of this sort of stuff. Mathematics was the worst. I would sit there and I would analyze all the steps that they skipped getting, you know, because they're saying, you know, first there's this theorem, then there's this theorem, and of course this follows. And this does not follow. There are four steps that they skipped. And you're supposed to just... So that's what they're on about. And they're right. If you want the person to remember, you know, the scientific principle or whatever, just tell them the principle, right? But what if that's not the objective? And here's the challenge. You know, remember in my talk I said, you know, we don't have agreements on outcomes. What Kirshner, Sweller, and Clark, and in the U.S., Willingham and others, think that learning is the acquisition of a body of content. The Carnap stuff that I was talking about, right? But that isn't the purpose of learning. The purpose isn't to have them remember the formula. Even if you think it's foundational, arguably it's not, right? The purpose is to have them able to think in that kind of way. You know, to be, you know, if it's mathematics, to think, to see the world like a mathematician sees the world. And so, the only way to do that is to actually force them to struggle with the same sort of problems that a mathematician does. It'll take longer to learn the principle. Totally agree. They will probably get lower test scores in tests that test for their recall of these principles. Given and proven. No question about it. Now the evidence supports what they're saying. But that's not the purpose of an education. We don't care if they just remember a bunch of formulas. Particularly now, where all of human knowledge changes every 18 years. Just don't need them to do that. What we do need them to do is to be able to figure this stuff out for themselves. They have to go through the struggle.
Excuse me, but are you... I'm just wondering, is what you're talking about, is it more about primary education? Would you envisage university education in the same manner?
Yeah.
I mean, what about educating scientists? What about educating people who need to push what we know forward, you know, mm-hmm. and build on that, like, you know, the body, the giants, etc.?
That's when it's even more important, right? And that's why I spent like a quarter of the talk today talking about this, right? Being a scientist, being anybody at the forefront, you know, being an artist, being a musician, is seeing the world in that way, being part of that community, not having this base of knowledge. And there's the reason, you know, and this is my own experience, there's a simple reason for that, especially now, nobody can have all of that knowledge. Take physics, for example. There's too much knowledge in physics for someone to have it all.
I just think it would be a shame for someone to spend 20 years working on something and then it turns out that it has already been written.
Oh, yeah, clearly.
I'd feel sorry for such a person.
Yeah, I would feel sorry for such a person too. I think the reality today is that lots of people are in this situation.
Yeah. Even though they
yeah.
read a lot, yeah.
I'm hoping that by making young people a part of the community of practitioners, that they're actually in the community when this thing was written in the first place. And, you know, they won't know everything, they won't cover everything, but they'll be in the same place where these things are talked about. And I think that's more important than giving them a certain body of facts. It's my view, anyways. Is that helpful?
Yes, thank you very much.
And just, nobody has to believe me on any of this stuff. You know, I mean, I always stress that. I have two rules about things that I say. The first rule is, somebody else has already said it, and probably better than me. And the second rule is what I just said. I could always be wrong. And there's always room for doubt and skepticism, and anything I say can and should be questioned. I encourage that.
Can I question one thing?
No, no questions allowed.
Because you have put, I don't know, maybe you have asked this question.
That's fine.
But while talking about connectivism, you were presenting it as in a sort of an opposition to constructivism.
Yeah.
And for me, this is just two faces of the same thing, more or less. I mean, here you focus in constructivism, you focus more on the scaffolding. Mm-hmm. And here you focus more on the fact that the scaffolding is never built by yourself, that it's changing, that you put things out, and that it's not the most important thing, the scaffolding itself, but what you do with it and how you change it. And can't we just think or connect connectivism with constructivism?
Okay. The first part is the part where I'm going to agree with you. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of overlap between constructivism and connectivism. And constructivism got a lot right. Knowledge is best when in some way created by the student as opposed to simply delivered to them like a package of content. For example, and you know, a lot of the methods and the practice, Canada went from an instructivist system to a constructivist system nationally, and we've gotten terrific results from it, like terrific results using traditional metrics, which is really quite astonishing. So I have a lot of good things to say about constructivism. Where I disagree with constructivism, there's a few things. The role of the teacher, I think, is different in connectivism than in constructivism. In constructivism, it's a lot more like the slogan, right? Being a guide at the side, etc. In connectivism, the teacher is more a member of the network that students are a part of. So you're part of this same environment. You don't have this principal distinction between the role of the teacher and the role of the student. And if you were to characterize the role of the teacher, it's about modeling and demonstrating rather than providing coaching and support. That's not to say that there isn't a role for coaching and support. That's a good thing. It's something that constructivism brought in, but it's a different role. It's a different function. So there's that.
So it's like another step forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other thing is, constructivists talk a lot about, to use the phrase, making meaning, right? And I find that phrase to be completely mysterious. The idea, the core concept of constructivism in education is drawn from the idea of constructivism in science, where students are, in a very deliberate and intentional way, building models or representations of the world. And I don't agree that that's the process of cognition. If I had to be characterized, and of course probably can't be, but if I had to be characterized, my model, and I don't think George Siemens agrees with this, so I should be clear, but my model of cognition is similar to direct perception. Mm-hmm. No models built.
So it's the emergence.
Yeah. So, it matters a lot to George that there is an object out there in the world, a real world with real chairs, that we are building models of in our mind. To me, I don't care whether there's a chair there or not, right? All I have access to are my own experiences, my own perceptions, and the theory with all the neurons and that is a way of explaining how I have that. But my subjective experience is only of what's inside my own mind.
Have you ever had people pointing out to you that that might lead to extreme unconnectivity? Like us being so subjective at the end of the day, because
everyone has his own emergence recognition patterns, and so how do we connect?
There's no objective reality to communicate on.
Yeah, there's two stories there. Okay, so the one story is the how we interact is a syntactic thing, right? So, it's like, how do pipes fit together, right? Well, they have the same kind of thread. How does the light bulb fit in the socket, right? The syntactic structure of it. But the other side of the story is, as far as I can tell, we actually do have these very different subjective representations. Not representations. We have very different subjective inner lives. I mentioned the story about today, and I could look it up now because I have internet, but how the ancient Greeks perceived color very differently from the way we do today. But we also know that how you perceive color is different from me and different for her.
Between genders.
Different. Take a word. Take a word. Any word in any language. You can pick the word. And ask a group of people, here's the word, what do you think of when you hear that word? If you have 20 people, you will get 30 different answers. Right? I use the word Paris a lot to make this example. Think of the word Paris. What do you think of? Do you think of the Eiffel Tower?
We have a question about the question, right? So just finish your sentence and then.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think of the Eiffel Tower? Do you think of Paris Hilton? Do you think of Kurt Vonnegut Jr., who had a character in his books called Paris Trout? You know what I mean? Or, there's an old movie using the same name called Paris Trout, but he's a detective in 1940s Los Angeles. Did you think of that? No. You all think of Paris differently. Some of you have been to Paris, some of you have not. Some of you have happy memories of Paris, some of you have sad memories, some of you are like Humphrey Bogart and you'll always have Paris. See what I mean? Everybody.
Every word evoking a picture in our mind.
But nobody will think of New York, right?
Yes, that's
exactly.
Talking what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Let's connect.
Yeah. Well, and that's what happens, right? Yeah. You find these little strands and you slowly build, as Quine calls these analytical hypotheses, right? Our own personal theories about what the meaning of a word could possibly be in a language. So, yeah.
But you agree with us that Paris is not New York.
No, but when you said that, I thought of Charles Lindbergh, who flew from New York to Paris.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
This I agree.
Ja po polsku zapytam, będę prosił o tłumaczenie, dobrze?
Oczywiście.
Jako zawodowy pesymista.
So,
you hear a question from a professional pessimist.
I like professional pessimists.
Pytanie, tak, pytanie jest, jakie są słabe strony konektywizmu? I od razu powiem, o co mi chodzi. Chodzi mi o to, o czym wspomniał pan Raus, dotyczące tego sposobu aktualnie istniejącego w korporacjach 70-20-10, 70-20-10, który u mnie wzbudza przerażenie. Bo jeżeli mówimy o tym, że korporacja, 70% wiedzy, którą zdobywa pracownik, jest wynikiem kontaktów z innymi ludźmi. To znaczy, że oni za przeproszeniem międlą w kółko to samo i nie są kreatywni.
70 to było doświadczenie.
Doświadczenie.
20
to było
doświadczenie. 10 klasów, a 20
to ale doświadczenie w tym sensie angielskim to znaczy nie jako doświadczenie eksperymentu, tylko doświadczenie
przeżycie.
Jako przeżycie.
Tak, czyli... Ale to nie musi być przeżycie z drugą osobą.
Ale przepraszam, ale w systemie. Chciałbym wysłuchać pytanie do końca, czy tu ma. Przy takiej dyskusji to ja wziąłem szansę.
We don't need you anymore.
I like the way this is working.
Strach to jest na przykład, inaczej, tam jest tego, co ja zrozumiałem z wykładu, połączenia między ludźmi będą niesamowicie, są niesamowicie istotne w rozwoju wiedzy. Natomiast jest to przyczyna, dlaczego ja nie mam konta na Facebooku, mam nadzieję, że nigdy nie będę miał, bo ja się boję tego, że będę zalany informacjami całkowicie zbędnymi, że te 70% informacji, które kolą, to jest tylko, słuchaj, rząd zajmuje się papierami, Harry zajmuje się papierem do tonera, tamtym, to jest bagaż informacji, które są zbudowane na obsługę rzeczy absolutnie niekreatywnych.
Muszę pozwolić sprecyzować.
Właśnie, to jest moje pytanie, jest takie, czy w momencie, w którym postawimy na sieciowanie, rozumiane jako wymianę informacji, nie stracimy możliwości kreowania informacji, bo ja na przykład teraz jak włączę internet i sobie wpiszę hasło, na przykład nogi do stołu, to mi się pokażą typowe nogi do stołu. 200 milionów różnych typowych nóg do stołu. I to mi stawia klamki na oczy. I ludzie, którym my teraz, uczniowie, studenci, których my nauczymy tworzenia nauki przez wzajemne kontakty, będą co robili? Powielali to, co już wiedzą. Czy konektywizm, tak rozumiany, nie jest zabójcą kreatywności? To jest moje pytanie też o słabe strony. Głównie słabe strony, czy to dobrze w ogóle zrozumiałe?
All right, so that's one question.
Yes.
So generally the question is about the weak points of connectivism,
sure.
The weaknesses of connectivism, because in the morning you mentioned the 70-20-10 proportion, which terrifies me.
I came up with that about 3 in the morning, so.
But in international corporations, it means that 70% of knowledge is, people get 70% of knowledge through connections between each other. And connections between people, of course, are important when it comes to development of knowledge. I personally, I do not have a Facebook account because I'm afraid that I will be overwhelmed by loads of unnecessary information because if you say 70% of information is irrelevant. So if we practice networking, if we treat networking as a priority, we exchange information. So if we concentrate on exchanging information, aren't we going to lose our ability to create new information? What I mean, if you Google a table, for example, you see 200 almost identical images of a table, which possibly kills your creativity. So students, as a consequence, they tend to copy, not to be creative. So again, what are the weaknesses of connectivism? And don't you think that connectivism can kill creativeness?
That's a great question. It has a bunch of different parts. I mean, what is creativity right off the bat? we could spend an hour talking about what creativity is. It may relieve you to know I closed my Facebook account. I don't use Facebook either because it was full of garbage. A really pivotal moment for me in my, academic development came in the 1990s, the early 1990s, when Francesco Varela came to the University of Alberta and gave a talk at the hospital. He was talking about immunology, which I didn't realize, but that was kind of a stretch for him. But the key point that he made that I took to heart is that connectivity isn't always a good. That there is, you don't want everyone to be connected to everyone. You don't want everything to be connected to everything. Because all you get is noise.
Yeah.
Right? You need some connection, because if nobody is connected to anyone, all you get is silence. And in fact, these two states, no connection, total connection, they're static. They're what I would call network death. Right? Varela drew a slope between zero connectivity and total connectivity, and then there's a line along that slope, a tangent along that slope, that represented, at least in the case of immunology, ideal connectivity. Okay? So, I totally agree with the concern that too much connectivity results in too much noise. It overwhelms. A human cannot function that way. A neuron cannot function that way. In fact, there are, different kinds of autism are cases where your neurons are overwhelmed. Different kinds, there are various disorders that are based on, too little or too much connectivity in the brain. So, a big part of what I did with what Varela taught me is I asked myself, what are the conditions of a network that most optimally promote this, sweet spot of connectivity? What are the conditions of a network that create a condition of dynamic connectivity, but not overwhelming connectivity? And there's a lot of material. If you read, for example, Duncan J. Watts, I've forgotten the name of his book. It's on the tip of my tongue. 6 Degrees. Or Alfred Laszlo Barabasi's book, Linked, which they're pop books, right? They're not technical books, but they express the concepts. And there are, I'm losing the point. There are descriptions in these books of the mathematics of self-organizing networks. And these mathematics describe how you reach that sweet spot. And then I look at that and I say, okay, what kind of networks result in these kind of mathematics? A simple example, and Barabasi describes this. What are the conditions for a disease to sweep through a society? Because that's a type of connectivity too, right? Like Ebola. So, if the probability of a person catching the disease and passing it on to someone else is greater than one, then the disease will spread through society. If the probability is less than one, it won't. The problem is with Ebola, the probability is greater than one. So how did we all not get Ebola? And the response is, well, we're not all connected to each other. There are gaps in our network. There are communities. There is a modularity of the network. And these conditions are created when you have things like diversity in the network, when you have different groups of connections to different groups of individuals, a network topology that is not even, but is clustered. And so that's the basis where I talk about the principles of connectivity. I think, and this is a point that James Surowiecki made, again, it's a surface level book, not a deep level book, but in his book, The Wisdom of Crowds, what he talked about, when he talked about a network learning isn't a question of voting. It isn't a question of mass. And this is how network knowledge is very different from, for example, democratic knowledge. In democratic knowledge, people vote, and the most votes win. It's a question of mass. But in network knowledge, it's a question of structure. It's a question of organization. And so that's the difference. Facebook, by design, emphasizes mass. Facebook, by design, tries to connect you to as many different people as possible. You know, you're supposed to get more and more and more followers and follow more and more people. Twitter is like that too. And the result is noise, right? But a system or a mechanism where there is a structure, an organization, not imposed, but one that grows and develops naturally, where the organization is what matters, that's the kind of network where people are not overwhelmed. I sometimes think of it as the concept, a community of communities. So there's interactivity, but there's also locality. Does that make sense? I'm sorry I went on for so long, but...
I have a short comment or maybe a question concerning this point, that how does it happen that at least I have the impression that now the networks that are ruled by this mass...
Yeah.
By network, you mean social networks.
Social information networks, that they are somehow stronger or at least growing quicker mm-hmm. than the ones that are built on some on other structure.
Yeah.
So, and isn't it dangerous?
Yes, it's very dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous. There are people like Evan Williams, who's currently creating Medium. He created, I think, Blogger. I think he was implicated. I forget his exact history. He's written about this. The web, he says, is broken. And I agree. As an analogy, we can think of, Facebook and Twitter are like diseases. Right? They're like cancers, literally like cancers, where there's no organization, there's just this massive explosion of whatever that is.
But isn't self-organized what it is by definition?
No, it isn't. That's just it. Facebook isn't. Facebook is governed by the algorithms. It's not self-organized.
But teenagers, when they self-organize, they mm-hmm. have to connect to everyone.
They want to connect to everyone they know. And it's really interesting to look at you know, just the trends that affect the development and growth of these networks. And because there's a lot of them, right? You know, we hear about Facebook and Twitter. If I'm to believe you know, the literature in this area, and maybe I do, maybe I don't, teens are moving away from Facebook now. And they're moving to smaller networks, more localized networks, and networks where the content isn't preserved.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Benches. Snapchat. Is
Instagram.
That
Instagram
similar? So
mostly because parents don't use Facebook.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, mostly because you see, and you know, when parents use your social network, that's a sign that there's too many people on your social
right,
network.
So there are people they don't want to connect with.
Yeah.
Right?
So, no, it's sort of like the teenagers are our body's antibodies, trying to repair the system. That's an interesting analogy. So, you know, there is hope. I use, you know, and the other thing too is things like Facebook and Twitter and others are centralized. And because they're centralized, they're based on mass, they're based on advertising, they're based on pushing content out to people. And so there's alternative systems that are distributed. So there's no single central location. This is, in fact, what I'm trying to build myself, is a distributed, non-centralized mechanism for learning technology. And I have a whole other set of presentations about that under the heading of personal learning. So instead of Facebook, I use a service called Mastodon. And Mastodon is what they call a federated social network. So there's no central site. Rather, there's a bunch of different sites and they're interlinked together.
Mastodon.
Mastodon.
Okay.
So when you join Mastodon, and it's a bit tricky, right? Because you don't just join Mastodon, you find a Mastodon instance and then you join that. But it's okay. You can get it like as an app on your phone. And it will suggest, you know, you could join this instance or that instance. And each one has different rules, different memberships, and so on. You can connect in between instances, but it's distributed. It's not centralized. It's a lot better. Is it the solution? No, somebody's going to spoil it.
Przyporządkowania cech do przedmiotu. Przykład tam był szary pijac, czy coś takiego było. Czy nie można sobie wymyśleć takiego sposobu kreowania wiedzy? To jest zresztą chyba Lem wpadł 40 lat temu, Stanisław Lem, gdzie zbierzemy wszystkie, nazwijmy to, przedmioty i wszystkie cechy. Zrobimy wszystkie możliwe połączenia. A potem będziemy tylko sprawdzać, które z nich jest prawdziwe. Jeżeli na przykład szukamy rozwiązania nowego źródła energii, zupełnie innego, innego niż jądrowa, innego niż słoneczna, innego niż jakakolwiek inna, no to wypiszmy to, co w ogóle jest możliwe i cechy. Z tych połączeń wszystkich możliwych, któreś pokaże nam to rozwiązanie. Czyli nie musimy w ogóle pracować. Po prostu wypisujemy wszystkie możliwe połączenia, a potem po kolei sprawdzamy. Czy możemy tak kierować wiedzę? To jest pytanie. Mm-hmm. Czy znając tak, metody, znaczy pytanie jest takie, no bo pokazywał na wykładzie to przyporządkowanie przedmiotu i cechy, prawda? Jako możliwość opisania świata. A skoro można opisać świat przy użyciu znanych nam słów, przymiotników, rzeczowników, no to sztuczna inteligencja, czy ta technika pokazywana przez niego, te sieci neuronowe, wykreują nam nowe rozwiązania. Nie będziemy w ogóle mówić, no bo skoro można wszystko opisać, to tak będziemy kreować wiedzę.
Czy
chodzi o kreować coś, co jest chodzi o możliwość wykreowania rzeczywistości na podstawie znanych nam cech. Pytanie jest, czy to nie jest pomysł na zastosowanie sieci. Trochę przewrotne, ale...
All right, so it's a question, a bit of a question, a bit of an idea. During your presentation you mentioned objects with some specific properties, like a grey dog, for example.
Like, I'm sorry?
Grey dog.
Like a grey dog.
Grey dog, yeah, okay, yeah.
Just an example. Mm. So the question is, can we come up with a system to create knowledge, something like Stanislaw Lem invented 40 years ago, in which we gather all objects with all possible properties, and then we analyze all the possible connections between the objects and the properties in order to find out which one is real. So for example, we analyze the energy, solar energy, nuclear energy, etc., in order to find out which is the optimal way of producing energy. So maybe finding this one optimal, the best connection, will give us solution to a given problem. So can we create knowledge in such a way? So if we can describe the world with all the possible adjectives, so to say, so maybe we could use artificial intelligence to analyze all the possibilities, and then create new solutions, create new reality. What do you think?
So first of all, I want to say, I've read Stanislaw Lem.
Oh, great. Love you.
Memoirs in a Bathtub?
Yes.
Classic. Memoirs found in a bathtub, rather. Classic. Absolutely. So, yeah. Although the question makes me think more of William Tenn, who wrote Of All Possible Worlds. Anyhow, what you'd if we are working with gray dogs and similar things, then what you've described is the philosophy of Rudolf Carnap. And the idea of Carnap's state space, which I just briefly mentioned during the talk, is exactly that. All possible objects, all possible properties of these objects, all possible relations between them. And then, if we observe only a few, we should be able to work out the rest. And, as an aside, and I even put a little box on the slide that said detour, that's what certain approaches in artificial intelligence today are trying to do. And definitely fields like learning analytics, that's what they're trying to do. And so we get languages like XAPI, which is a language which is used to describe actions, trying to describe all possible actions, all possible outcomes, within a certain domain. And that's also where we get, you know, we can, from Carnap's state space, we can derive things like Bayes' theorem of conditional probability, and that underlies a lot of even the neural network stuff that's happening today. That uses symbols like gray and like dog. The problem is the symbols. Because, as I mentioned before, each person has a different interpretation for a symbol. What you think of as gray, you think of as brown, you think of as light black, you think of as dark white, and I think of as ugly. And it's what Quine was getting at when he says there's no analytic synthetic distinction. We can't separate the predicate gray from the theory of the world in which it is embedded. So, but connectivism is sub-symbolic. Connectivism is about individual neurons, and it takes millions of neurons to create one symbol. So maybe we could do it with connectivism. In theory, it's possible. But I think in practice, it's impossible. Because in a single mind, a single brain, there are 10 billion neurons. And 2 to the 10 minus 1 possible connections between them. Or 2 to the 10 billion minus 1, I should say. Which is more connections than there are atoms in the universe. So we could imagine a state space for one person. But now in a society, of course, there are millions of people. So now we have, say, you know, in a country, what's the population of Poland?
38 million.
So 38 million people times 10 billion possible connections times the number of connections each individual mind can have, also times the number of connections individuals can have with each other for each possible state. And the number is just astronomical. So it could work, but I just don't think it's possible. But it's a neat idea. But I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever that Stanislaw Lem read Rudolf Carnap's work. Have I broken the library? I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and making this a very interesting discussion.
I have maybe more questions.
Sure.
That was mostly interesting. I'm just thinking if I can, let myself make such a comment. I think you're an extreme subjectivist, right? You're an artist, not a practitioner in science.
That's not true.
No, sorry.
I work with the National Research Council.
I'm not saying about what you really do. I'm talking about the mentality.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was tested. I sound like Sheldon. Yes, I'm not crazy. I was tested. No. I was tested for, you know, they have the different personality types, and they have like this chart, like, you know, the circle. It's actually a circle. You have different dimensions, and I have a creativity spike that goes past the boundaries of the chart.
Creative.
Yeah. So apparently I test as very creative.
So but we go also in the direction of visionary, right?
Yeah. But that's also how I do science, which is funny because everybody else on my floor is very grounded, very practical, very focused on their algorithms and on use cases and things like that, and I just don't think that way at all.
But heuristics is not what you are proposing either, is it?
No.
I think you are proposing a world with beautiful and undoable algorithms.
Oh, I like that. I like beautiful but undoable algorithms. but I am practical, right? I write software. Not good software, because I'm just one person, but I write software. I write learning systems. The MOOC that I talked about, I wrote all the software for it. So You know, there's a certain sense in which I have to be grounded, right? The things that I think about and talk about have to actually work. And I think they work.
Yeah, of course, yeah, I don't know. I was just wondering, probably that skill comes from the traditional education of playing.
You'd think, but no.
No, it doesn't.
My traditional education is in philosophy, but I came into philosophy having read tens of thousands of science fiction books, including Stanislav Lem, among others, right? Which is why I'm already familiar with them. And so when I arrived at university, I started late, right? I didn't go straight from high school into university. I had an involuntary gap years because I was also poor. So I came into you and science fiction paperbacks, 10 for 50 cents. So they were fantastic. I came in with this huge philosophical background already. But computer science, I taught myself. So I taught myself how to program, software design, all of that, taught myself. Journalism and media, I learned by working on a newspaper. So actual grounded experience. So I think personally that my own education is more similar to the model I'm describing.
What you preach, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, and to me, the evidence that it works is, you know, what I live with every day. Now, I know that one instance does not create a generalization. I know that. You know, because I've been criticized for thinking, you know, everybody else should think like I did.
Or even more so, everybody should be like I am, which would be a great thing.
Or it would be a nightmare, yeah.
I don't know. I think it would be great for everyone to, you know, to be creative and self-organized and self-directed and all.
I think it would be better in many ways. You know.
Yes, but how do you feel with your ideas maybe not being implementable?
Well,
ideas
of education, what it should look like, the vision, the idealistic, beautiful vision, but maybe it's not implementable.
Part of the reason, like, I'm in a certain sense, I'm a pragmatist as well.
I'm sorry?
A pragmatist, okay? You remember the four principles that I talked about? Autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity? I often describe those principles as tools that people working in a traditional system can use to make their traditional system a little bit better, right? If you have the choice, for example, if you have the possibility, increase the autonomy of students in your classroom. Help them make their own decisions, right? If you have the possibility, embrace diversity. Cultivate different experiences rather than doing the same thing every day or every week or whatever. Have friends and communicate with people from different cultures. Study different religions. My undeclared minor in university was religious studies. So I studied Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam and Sufism and Shinto, which is weird, Taoism, and of course Christianity, various flavors, Judaism, and not just, you know, what they teach, but what their histories were and all of that, because seeing the different ways of seeing the world helped me appreciate the world more. You know, it's these little things. So, I expect that the education will not transform itself into my vision. Not going to happen. Neither will the political system, neither will the social order in the economy, right? I'm not fine with that, but I understand that that's the case. But I think that a lot of what I talk about moves us a little bit in that direction. And, you know, a little bit better is better. And if that's what I produce, that's what I'll live with. But I'd really rather, no. Well, ultimately, it's like everybody, right? If I got to Utopia, I'd probably be disappointed. So, yeah, that's a danger, I agree. I mean, we know that the human mind can be subjected to propaganda. We know this. We've seen it in cults, we've seen it in entire societies. And the model I'm describing is like the model of a human brain. So it's not foolproof. And that's something that concerns me. That's something that that I've written about, right? And at a certain point, how did I phrase it? It's like any science, any system of inference, the outcome of that system could be wrong. Logic and mathematics are like that too. People can misuse mathematics and physics and use it to build nuclear bombs, right? So there's always going to be a necessity to be vigilant, even with connectivism. It's not going to be, it's not the single solution. So that's one weakness for sure. It's not perfect. Never will be. Another, I mean, it is hard to structure a system so that it functions connectively. Look at the example of human societies. There's the contrast between a purely free market system, which is completely self-organizing, and a completely designed system, like, you know, like the, a fascist system or a Soviet system, where everything is managed. And these both obviously have excesses. A connective system is somewhere in between, where there is diversity and autonomy and all of that, but where the structure of the network is designed so that it's not the case that anybody can do anything, And it's not the case that anybody can control anything or everything. Historically and practically, that turns out to be really hard to build. Societies have, at best, only approximated that. You know, but if you look, you know, in my own society, for example, there's a great disparity of wealth. And that's a network failure. And in my mind, that's because we have not designed our social network properly. If you look online, the other questioner was talking about Facebook. That's another case where the network has been designed improperly and we get too much noise, too much garbage. It's hard, to build an hour. Nature does it really well. You know, but nature has had billions of years to get this right. And even then, right, you have an ecology like a forest, and it's a finely balanced network, but it can be destroyed by fire in an instant. You know? So even nature has trouble doing this. And that's probably the biggest challenge of connectivism, is designing the network right so that the autonomy and the structure are appropriately balanced. Boy, do I ever. When I was younger, more than 20 years ago, actually, I wrote and published online something called Stephen's Guide to Logical Fallacies. And it was a collection of errors in reasoning and how to spot them and how to correct them. And I spent a lot of time since then thinking about that subject. And there's a branch of my thinking I now call critical literacies. Right. So it's funny when, because people talk about foundations of knowledge, foundational knowledge. If there were any foundational aspect to connectivism, it would be these critical literacies. And like everything else that I've come up with, I stole it from other people. But for example, one of the critical literacies I classify under the heading of syntax. And what is syntax? Syntax is structure. Syntax is regularity, commonality, similarity. It can be rules or principles. It can be axioms, right? It's like, you know, the traditional common understanding of syntax, but extend it a bit. So you can be better or worse at syntax, right? You can train yourself, for example, to see regularities in data and in facts. You know, experts in different disciplines, this is exactly what they've done. Like a wine taster, for example, will use syntactic properties of wine to identify different types of grapes. Or even the rules of how to taste wine, right? You can taste it properly or you can taste it poorly. So, but I think of this as not learning what the rules are, that's an incidental thing. More, I think of it as being good with rules, right? Being able to see rules, regularities, being able to find them, being able to define them, to use them. There's a skill of syntax. So I have six critical literacies. Syntax, semantics, makes sense. Pragmatics or context, pragmatism or use, cognition, like induction or deduction, and change. That's my nod to Hegel. So we can have skills. Now, you know, it's a classification system, right? But we can have these basic skills in these basic elements of cognition, right? And I think of them as the outcome. You know, if you learned in a connectivist way and you were successful, you would acquire this set of skills. And then these skills, in turn, serve as a corrective mechanism to help prevent us from error. That's the best I've got. And it could still be wrong. Sometimes I feel like Hegel, the system builder, but I'm not really.
Where do you work on a daily basis?
Where do I work, or what do I work on? I didn't hear the question.
Where?
I work in a government research lab in Ottawa, Canada. Yeah, I work for the government. It varies a lot. I mean, this is me working. But on a day-to-day basis, many days I spend writing software. Other days I spend writing papers, academic papers, or popular articles. Other days, less recently, although I'll be doing it more soon, designing courses. So like the MOOCs, you know, the online courses that I taught with George Siemens and others. I go to meetings.
And these courses are for whom? You designed the courses for?
Oh, these, yeah. Well, I used to design courses for college classes, but today I design courses to help people understand connectivism and logic and knowledge. So they're MOOCs, they're open online courses.
Okay.
I sometimes evaluate funding proposals. I review academic papers.
Are you a lecturer for students?
No.
Yeah.
I used to. I have about 9 years experience as a lecturer. But now I'm focused purely on research and developing online learning technologies. I miss lecturing. When I taught, mostly what I taught was philosophy. So, I specialized in logic, but I also taught philosophy of science, ethics, issues in philosophy. things like that. I've taught a number of courses about the internet. So at the college, for example, I taught, what is the internet, how do you do HTML, things like that. Very practical courses.
Question,
right? Sure, of course. So I actually have a vision statement on my website. So it's hard to remember it word for word. But it's the idea that of a society where everybody can reach their fullest potential in whatever vocation or interest that they choose, whether it's in academics or auto mechanics or music or art or whatever. And so this is a society where knowledge and resources are freely shared and not hoarded, and not kept away from people. That's basically, it's not word for word, but that's basically it. It's funny, when I was in university, I've been called a Marxist a few times. I'm not a Marxist, but I've been called that. George Siemens and I were once called techno-communists, which is kind of funny. But probably the most accurate description came when somebody called me a moderate socialist and a radical Democrat. And I think the two things go hand in hand, right? Like sharing and autonomy. I think you can't have one without the other. Sharing without autonomy is, a form of fascism. Autonomy without sharing is a form of fascism. But both of them together are wonderful.
How about fascism?
Okay. I know, I just thought of this now. So. But it's right, right?
Sharing
without autonomy is a form of fascism, right? Autonomy without sharing is a form of fascism. But together, they're wonderful. Does that make sense? I only just thought of that way of expressing it now, so. But it feels right, you know? I mean the big challenge, in North America, the big social challenge that we're facing now is from this idea that anybody can do anything. So, you know, anybody can be a racist, it's okay. Anybody can hoard wealth, it's okay. Anybody can sell a defective product and lie about it. And, you know, there should be no regulation to stop it. Anybody can own a gun. All right? Autonomy in everything. But that's, you know, I mean, and we see now, I mean, that's just a different kind of fascism. It's, you know, you become the property of corporate owners, or, you know. So that's why I'm phrasing it the way I am now, because, you know, it's the issue that we're facing at home with people like Donald Trump. It's a big issue for us. But,
of course, what do you mean a big issue? A positive or negative?
Negative. Oh, it's negative.
In terms of values, or
in terms of this political idea that has developed that there should be no regulations in society. And if there's no regulation, there's no protection from anything. You know, somebody walks up to you on the street and shoots you. That happens to thousands of people every day in the United States. So that sort of thing. Or, you know, because everybody can have a gun. There's no limit. So there are more guns in the United States than there are people. And you're allowed to carry them with you. George Simmons works at the University of Texas in Arlington. They passed a law there that it is illegal for the university to tell people they cannot carry a gun into a classroom. It's craziness.
So what's the situation? The students come to lectures with guns.
Yeah. Can you imagine teaching in a classroom with your students with guns? And that's just madness.
So why can't you change that? Why isn't it changeable?
Well, they won't let me. Yeah. See, this is why I have a chain. I dropped my wallet. Although, arguably, the chain pulled the wallet out of my pocket. Okay. It's because of commercial interests. The people who make and sell guns are large corporations, and they have a very influential lobby, both in terms of persuading the public. They have an organization I call it propaganda, but also they use their wealth to influence politicians. So the politician is more worried about making the gun lobby angry than they are worried about people being killed. And so that's why it's so hard to change. Oh, three.
What values are the most appreciated now in North America, in the US, in Canada?
What values?
What values are the most appreciated in the US or Canada?
Yeah. The US and Canada are two very different countries. In Canada, like, people ask Canadians, what is our best achievement as a country? And Canadians say, our national health care system. Everybody in Canada receives free health care. You never pay. There's no limit.
Dentist as well.
No, not dentists. Yeah. I know. Exactly. And not glasses either. But everything else. So, actually there are limits. Like, pharmacy is sort of covered. It's very heavily regulated. But the point is, it's our socialized healthcare is what Canadians feel is our greatest achievement. So in Canada, you know, it's the value of the idea that everybody in our society is important. That nobody lacks for the most vital things. We have an advanced welfare system. People don't starve in Canada. I say that there are some exceptions. We're not perfect. Yeah. The United States, it's freedom. The idea that anybody can do whatever they want. Anybody can say whatever they want. Even if they are inciting other people to violence, that's not a problem. They do not have socialized health care, and the argument is it's so anybody can choose any doctor and any medicine that they want. Now, which is kind of weird, because in Canada, even with socialized health care, we have significant choice. We can choose any doctor we want. We can choose or refuse any medical treatment. You know, but the Americans, they see freedom differently. Yeah. In Canada, we have, or actually I'll say it the other way around. The United States has the slogan, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Canada has the slogan, peace, order, and good government. And that makes us two very different countries.
Let me come back to guns. How about Canadian students? Are they allowed to carry guns?
No. Oh, goodness, no. There is gun ownership in Canada. There's too much gun ownership in Canada. But it's a fraction of what's in the United States. We have gun regulations. Many types of guns are simply illegal, like automatic weapons, for example. You cannot carry a gun openly down the street in Canada. And people would be very upset if you did. so, and Canadians like it that way. Sure.
Okay. So yeah. Last question. Three key words in connectors. Three most important words in connectors.
Well, I have four, right?
Okay.
Autonomy.
Autonomy.
Openness. Diversity. Interactivity. Those to me are core. Birds of a feather flock together.
Okay, let me explain that because we don't have a similar saying in Polish, so it needs an explanation.
Yeah. Makes sense now. Thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it.
So we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Trzeba mojej pomocy, to ja zawsze jestem do was.